Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the first headline across the top of the page. General Parts gets $258 million in deal. And this article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far right side, there's a picture, a close-up picture of a man wearing a suit and tie. Caption reads, O. Temple Sloan Jr. started General Parts in 1961. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Raleigh. Raleigh's General Parts has sold 33 of the company's distribution centers and office buildings in Raleigh and across the country for $258 million. Founded by longtime Raleigh businessman and chairman O. Temple Sloan Jr., General Parts International Incorporated, the largest operator of Carquest auto parts stores in the nation, sold the properties to a commercial real estate investment trust managed by W.P. Carey & Company of New York, which specializes in financing long-term sale-leaseback deals. Following the sale, General Parts signed several leases of varying lengths to occupy the buildings. The Sloan family is the majority owner of the General Parts empire. The ownership change should go largely unnoticed by General Parts' more than 900 employees and clients in Raleigh because the agreement includes a 20-year lease to keep the company's operations in the building through June 31, 2031, with multiple lease extension options. The deal that closed on December 16 included General Parts' four corporate headquarters buildings and its distribution center off Millbrook Road in Raleigh, valued at more than $26 million, according to Wake County deed records. General Parts also sold 28 automotive equipment distribution centers across the U.S. and Canada, according to documents filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission on behalf of W.P. Carey's Corporate Properties Associates 17 Global Fund. The portfolio included almost 3.6 million square feet of warehouse and office space. Guy Lawrence, a spokesman for W.P. Carey, verified that the information in the SEC documents was accurate. W.P. Carey of New York manages a portfolio with about $10 billion in real estate assets around the world. According to a report by Mizero Financial of Chicago, the dollar volume of sale-leaseback activity in 2010 was 50% higher than the year prior because of intense demand from public and private REIT investors. A major motivator for a company seeking a sale-leaseback deal is that in addition to providing quick cash for the company, it allows sellers to eliminate the building's book value and its liability on the company's balance sheet. Jerry Monash, leader of NIA Global's Investment Services Group in Atlanta, says the volume of sale-leaseback deals in 2011 will depend on whether expected changes are made to the federal tax laws that could require companies to begin writing down the total value of their lease contracts. If that happens, all leases become liabilities and there will be no more off-balance sheet leases, he says. Monash says that if the law is changed, sale leasebacks would still appeal to large companies and even governments that own large real estate portfolios and would rather have the cash from a sale. But he says a tax law change would damper smaller transactions. Neither O. Temple Sloan Jr. nor President and CEO Temple Sloan III returned calls for comment about the General Parts portfolio sale. Sloan Jr. also serves as chairman of the board of directors of Highwoods Properties, the largest real estate investment trust based in Raleigh, but Highwoods was not involved in the General Parts property sale. General Parts spokeswoman Dorothy Brown Smith says the company, which is privately owned, does not comment publicly about its business transactions and would provide no further details. The sale to W.P. Carey does provide a one-time cash windfall for a company that has been having to manage its expenses in a tough economy. A Forbes magazine report estimated that General Parts' revenue in 2009 was about $2.79 billion, which was a 4.2% decline from the company's high of $2.9 billion in 2008. The Forbes report also estimated that the company employed 16,800 workers in 2008, a figure that had dropped to 15,300 by the end of 2009. Financial data from 2010 is not yet available. General Parts is the largest member of a CarQuest marketing alliance that was formed in 1974. It owns about 1,400 of CarQuest's 3,400 auto parts stores across North America. Since Sloan founded the company in 1961, it has focused on growing relationships with independent auto repair shops, fleet garages, professional automotive service technicians, and mechanics, rather than banking heavily on retail stores geared to the weekend mechanic, as do competitors Pep Boys and others. And now we'll move on to the only other article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. And I should mention that the article we're about to read runs along the right side of the page, vertically along the page. But next to that and below the article we just read is a large in-color photos of the pictures of people who will be profiled in a group of articles inside of the Triangle Business Journal. The grouping of articles is called Beautiful Minds, a look at 10 local researchers in the Triangle trying to better the world. And we'll sample some of those a little later. But first, this last front page article, headline, Drug Abusers Drain Millions from Medicaid. And this article is written by James Gallagher, with the Dateline of Raleigh. In an effort to better control Medicaid costs, the state of North Carolina is implementing new systems aimed at curbing drug abuse by Medicaid patients. Nationally, more and more Medicaid patients are trying to game the system to feed prescription drug habits and to game pharmaceuticals for sale to other addicts. The Federal Drug Enforcement Agency recently arrested 33 Medicaid patients in New York who were using the healthcare system to pay for prescription drugs, mostly painkillers, that were then sold illegally. Medicaid provides health care to children, the poor, and some adults and some elderly people. The cost of the program is split between the state and federal governments, with North Carolina committing about $2.4 billion to the program in the fiscal year ending June 30, 2010, and the feds ponying up $9.5 billion. Abuse of drug benefits adds cost to an already overburdened program. The state last year saw its Medicaid expenditures come in at $221 million over budget. Any way we can save money to avoid cutting services is a good thing in our mind, says Chrissy Pearson, Governor Beverly Perdue's spokeswoman. To help reduce those costs and prevent fraud, the state is now using a prior approval system for prescription drugs that are most likely to be abused. Also, it will be implementing new data mining systems to scan Medicaid claims, looking for anomalous behavior. Much of the data mining will be done at the SAS Analytical Lab in Cary. Brad Dean, spokesman for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, says the data mining systems could save as much as $30 million a year, money that could be greatly needed as the state's Medicaid rolls are expected to swell by as many as 600,000 under federal health care reform legislation. The actions come as prescription drug abuse becomes more rampant. Barbara Heath, a diversion program manager with the DEA, says that as that abuse grows, they expect to see more people trying to use the Medicare and Medicaid systems to pay for the pills. The most common type of Medicaid prescription fraud, officials say, is doctor shopping, in which patients go to different physicians complaining of the same symptoms to be provided prescriptions for medication. They then have those prescriptions filled in various pharmacies. A 2009 report from the Government Accountability Office found that 65,000 Medicaid beneficiaries in five states, including North Carolina, visited six or more doctors in fiscal years 2006 and 2007 to obtain duplicate prescriptions for drugs. Those scams cost $63 million for the drugs alone. The physician visits add additional costs to the schemes. Greg Cutts, Managing Director of Forensic Audits and Special Investigations with the GAO and the report's author, says he believes such fraud totals tens of billions of dollars across the nation. Kurtz says he included North Carolina, along with New York, Illinois, Texas, and California, in the study because the state has a fairly robust Medicaid program. What makes the situation all the more frustrating, says Kutz, is that much of the fraud is preventable. Systems for tracking physician visits and prescriptions written and filled could prevent many patients from doctor shopping. Any money spent preventing such fraud would have a good return on investment, he says. And as I previously mentioned, most of the front cover, front page of the Triangle Business Journal was covered with a large ad for a group of articles inside the paper called Beautiful Minds, a look at 10 local researchers in the Triangle trying to better the world. And on the front page, they have pictures of each one, and it's made to look like a strip of film with a bluish background. But now we're going to turn and read one of those articles. The one we'll read has the headline, As Science and Fiction Diverged, She Chose Genetics. This is written by Frank Van Leeuwen with a dateline of Research Triangle Park. Allison Harrill's work on genes could soon lead to tests that determine just how safe or dangerous a drug is for individual patients. Sound like science fiction? It's becoming a reality, and it just so happens that Harrill, a 30-year-old research scientist at the Hamner Institutes for Health Sciences, is a science fiction buff who counts author Michael Crichton as a favorite. She notes that while Jurassic Park is a thriller about dinosaurs, the story is rooted in genetics research. A lot of his stories look at what can happen when things go wrong, she says. We're focused on what can happen when things go right. Many in the pharmaceutical field think Harrell has done a lot that's right. Harrell is a key part of the Hamner's research into how genetic variations can determine a patient's response to a drug. Professor David Threadgill, head of the genetics department at NC State University, taught Harrell when he was working at UNC Chapel Hill. He says Harrell's research could lead to tests that save drugs from being recalled from the market, a costly outcome for pharmas that have poured millions of dollars and years of research into drugs. He notes that drugs such as Merck's Vioxx have been withdrawn due to adverse cardiovascular effects. Although such drugs work for some, they pose significant risks for others. Threadgill says that if a drug's toxicity is better understood, it has a better chance of staying on the market and helping the patients best suited for it. Harrell's research uses mice as a model for the human population. Dr. Paul Watkins, who holds positions at both UNC Chapel Hill and the Hamner, says Harrell's use of a mouse model was a major step forward in drug safety research. No one before had used mice to predict drug toxicity. Research by Harrell and her colleagues won an outstanding published research award in 2009 from the Society of Toxicology. Watkins says Harrell's research holds the promise of eventually leading to tests for a range of drugs. The pharmaceutical industry is interested in using these tests to speed up drug development. One of the main bottlenecks in drug development is not in assessing whether a drug works, it's in determining whether a drug is safe, he says. These tests could do that. Tests have yet to be developed from Harrell's toxicological work, but she says the work is moving quickly. A number of pharmaceutical companies have reached out to the Hamner to work with her. Harrell says she has always been interested in science, and she knew even as a high school student who enjoyed science fiction that she wanted to study genetics. She says she became interested in toxicology because there is a clear connection between the research she does and its application in healthcare. I always had the sense that I wanted to do something that could affect patient health, Harrell says. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, You Think Economy Bites Here? Take a look at Charlotte. The fact that Charlotte and Mecklenburg County have been hit harder by the Great Recession than the Triangle has been well established to this point. Yet the comparisons keep popping up. For example, as in the 12 months from December 2009 through November 2010, the Employment Security Commission of North Carolina paid out $609 million to jobless people in Mecklenburg. That was more than the total payout in all three Triangle counties during the same months. During the period, Wake residents got $448 million, Durham residents received $121 million, and Orange residents got $37 million for a $606 million total. Statewide, the state paid out $5.52 billion during the period. The totals represent all benefit payouts and regular unemployment insurance, plus emergency and extended benefits. One of the best street names in big law is no more. Atlanta-based law firm Kilpatrick Stockton's merger with San Francisco-based Townsend & Townsend & Crew became official on January 1, depriving us of the pleasure of being able to roll the legally lyrical Killstock moniker off our tongues. Dialing up local managing partner Gary Joyner just won't be as much fun for biz now that we're left with a relatively boring Kilpatrick Townsend. Biz supposes you could go with Killtown, but that sounds more like an indie rock band than a bunch of aggressive barristers. Oh well, even though the firm doesn't have an office here, at least law insiders can take solace in the fact that the greatest legal street name still lives. That would be the New York City-based firm Morrison Foerster, or as they're lovingly known in the biz, MoFo. The Consumer Electronics Convention, CES, is being held in Las Vegas, as it is every year, so maybe it shouldn't come as a surprise that someone has put odds on the event. Betting website Bookmaker.com has calculated the odds of a number of anticipated product announcements being made at CES. Among them, a 28% chance that Verizon will announce a launch date for an iPhone, a 20% chance that Samsung will debut its first Google TV, and a 22% chance that HP and Palm will introduce a tablet. PC maker Lenovo, which has major operations in Mooresville, didn't figure into bookmakers' calculations. Did you know that January is National Radon Awareness Month? Well, neither did Biz. The Environmental Protection Agency is trying to get the word out, saying radon gas causes more than 20,000 deaths in the United States each year. The EPA says radon problems have been detected in almost every county in the United States. The Surgeon General and the American Lung Association recommend that all homes in the U.S. be tested for the naturally occurring and odorless radioactive gas. Raleigh's own Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Tift Merritt will team up with classic pianist Simone Dinnerstein on January 21 and 22 for a pair of shows at the Reynolds Industries Theater in Durham. The duo will perform Night, a collection of songs inspired by the hours from dusk to dawn. The show will feature songs written for the duo by artists such as Brad Meldow, Patty Griffin, Philip Lasser, and Talking Heads' great David Byrne. Merritt and Dinnerstein also will perform songs from their own extensive bodies of work. Tickets are $32 to $38, but Duke University students get in for just $5. Wondering what the best profession to work in right now is? Biz humbly suggests that Republican lobbyists should be near the top of the list after the GOP's impressive performance in the November elections. That leads us to this announcement. Raleigh-based government affairs and lobbying group Bailey & Dixon Solutions LLC has hired Jason Deans as a lobbyist. Deans worked as the campaign manager for U.S. Representative Patrick McHenry, Republican, North Carolina, in 2004, and later served as the legislator's chief of staff. Dean has been active in Republican circles for more than 15 years. Civil War buffs may have seen a local face while watching PBS this week. UNC Chapel Hill professor Joe Glattauer was among the experts interviewed for the documentary American Experience Robert E. Lee, which aired January 3 on WUNC-TV. Glattauer, who is the Stevenson Distinguished Professor of History, has written several books on the Civil War, including General Lee's Army, From Victory to Defeat, and The March to the Sea and Beyond, Sherman's Troops in the Savannah and Carolinas Campaigns. It looks like the conservative majority of Way County School Board got the leader it wanted. According to the North Carolina Justice Center's blog, Progressive Pulse, new Way County Superintendent Anthony Tata has a lot in common with Fox News commentator Glenn Beck, or at least Twitter thinks so. When signing up to follow someone's post, the social media site suggests other tweeters you may want to follow. Beck is among those that Twitter suggests that followers of Tata may like to track. A second location of the Meat House will open in the Triangle, this one at 5045 Falls of Noose Road in early April, by the same father-son team that operates the Meat House in Cary. Son Derek Wilkins and dad Craig Wilkins have signed a lease for the Raleigh space, where they will offer butchered premium meats, fresh produce, and gourmet grocery products from local vendors. The Meat House is a franchise operation that Derek took a liking to, and dad signed on to help, having closed out a 37-year career in technology. They found success with their first, the Meat House in Cary, and now are expanding to the capital city. "I am thrilled to get started on opening a new store in Raleigh," says Derek. "We have really enjoyed getting to know our customers in Cary and look forward to becoming a part of the Raleigh community as well." The franchise was founded in 2003 in New Hampshire and now has locations in 8 states besides North Carolina, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, Texas, Connecticut, and California. Residential Architect magazine has compiled what it calls its RA50, a short list of architects we love. And among those feeling the good vibes is Frank Harmon Architecture of Raleigh. Editor Claire Conroy says, "This collection comprises firms whose names keep rising to the top. Senior editors Nigel Maynard, Cheryl Weber, Megan Druding, and Bruce Snyder say the RA50 represents a broad collection of people who simply, day in and day out, do very good, interesting work. In 2003, a vacation home in the Bahamas designed by Harmon's firm was named RA's House of the Year. Most legal insiders around these parts know Britt Davis because he's asked them for money at some point. No, Davis isn't a beggar or even a no-account relative. He has served as director of development for Campbell University's law school since the spring of 2007. Now comes word that Davis is leaving that post. Don't worry, though he'll likely still be asking for your money, this time in his new capacity as the Vice President for Advancement at Campbell University. Davis assumed the new job January 1. The law school is searching for a replacement to serve in his old spot. Biz has some sad news to pass on to art aficionados in the Triangle. Ann Schroeder, the curator at Duke University's National Museum, died December 23 after a brief illness, according to a statement issued by the museum. The 56-year-old Schroeder had worked at Duke, where she also served as an adjunct assistant professor since 1999. NC State University's College of Engineering will kick off its 2011 first robotics competition on January 8. The event, according to the college, challenges high school contestants to solve a common problem in 6 weeks using the same set of parts. Based on that kind of criteria, Biz thinks they should require the winning team to help Sidney Lowe coach the men's basketball team. Say this for Chick-fil-A: the company markets with style. The fast food giant sent a local executive and its rather big cow mascot to the Triangle Business Journal offices on January 5 to promote the chain's new spicy chicken biscuits. The local executive brought a bag full of biscuits, fruit salad, plates, and even a red tablecloth on which to serve the food. The cow, still dressed in her pajamas, brought mini stuffed cows wearing the signature "Eat More Chicken" tagline. Clearly, as you can see, Chick-fil-A knows the path to get some face ink through Biz's stomach works every time. Now that the $22 million auction sale for 4 buildings in Highwood's office center has been finalized, the new owner has switched management companies. Grubb & Ellis, Thomas Linderman Graham of Raleigh, has taken over leasing and management of the office park from Craig Davis Properties of Cary. The property was foreclosed by Wells Fargo Bank and sold in a November auction. An entity managed by BlackRock Financial Management Incorporated of New York was the winning bidder. Now called the Arbor at Highwoods, the center comprises about 250,000 square feet of office space. Contributing to Biz were staffers James Gallagher, Chris Basden, Lee Weisbecker, Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Frank Van Leeuwen, Jeff Drew, and Dathan Kadzuk. Firms grow as revivified music catches on. That's the headline on our next article. This one's written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Durham. And the article runs horizontally across the top of page 3. But first, at the far left, there's a picture of a man. And you can see in the background behind him, looking down at the stage, two grand pianos sitting on the stage over his shoulder. The caption reads, John Walker jokes that he's solving the recession alone. The economic downturn hasn't slowed the growth of music technology company Zenith Sound Innovations, which has quintupled its employee count to about 30 in the past 2.5 years. And the Durham firm is working on an encore, hiring another 6 to 12 people in 2011. I'm single-handedly trying to solve the recession problem here, jokes John Walker, Zenith's chairman and chief technology officer. It took a while, but Zenith is starting to make some noise in local business circles thanks to its rapid employee growth, big-name local investors, and an impending move into a new office at the American Tobacco Complex's Power Plant Building. American Tobacco aims to be a hub for innovation and culture, says Michael Goodman in an email statement. Zenith, which some have compared to Pixar, combines the two. Goodman is the vice president of real estate for Capital Broadcasting Company, which owns American Tobacco. When it moves in later this year, Zenith will occupy the entire first floor of the power plant, which is about 11,000 square feet. Other building tenants include tech firms Digital Smiths and Pocket Gear. Walker and Peter Schwaller, veteran entrepreneurs who previously worked together at Ganymede Software, co-founded Zenith in 2002. The firm has generated buzz in music circles by re-recording performances of famous but deceased classical and jazz musicians. The company has re-performed works of artists ranging from Art Tatum to Glenn Gould to Sergei Rachmaninoff. Zenith's software deciphers the notes in a previously recorded piece of music, along with nuances such as how long a note is held or how hard a pianist strikes a key. A computerized piano then is used to re-record the performance using modern technology. Zenith had just 6 employees in 2008 when the private company started trying to drum up interest from venture capitalists for a $6 million fundraiser. The effort eventually paid off with an even bigger haul of $10.7 million in November 2009. Durham-based InterSouth Partners led that first round of funding, while Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting also participated. The fundraising led to veteran venture capitalist Kip Fry leaving InterSouth to join Zenith as chief executive officer. The company's board includes standout business names such as former Red Hat CEO and chairman Matthew Suslick and Bill Patry, the senior copyright counsel at Google Incorporated. Zenith, which takes its name from Senf, the German word for mustard, and I should say that Zenith, the company name, is spelled Z-E-N-P-H. The German word for mustard is spelled S-E-N-F. And Zenith, it takes its name from Zenith, the German word for mustard, started out recreating works by famous pianists. Now Walker and his team are branching out to include other instruments, including the saxophone, bass, and drums. Zenith's digital target customers were record companies, and the firm has a partnership with Sony Masterworks. For a while, Zenith averaged about 1 album a year, but Zenith amped up its workload in 2010, producing 5 albums, and hopes to complete 20 or more in 2011. Other revenue streams are also on the horizon. Zenith plans to release music editor software for piano owners later this year and also is exploring licensing opportunities for its re-recorded music. And our next article on page 3 of the Triangle Business Journal takes up a large portion of the center of the page. The article has a black border around it. The background inside the borders tannish beige color. First, at the top, there's a picture of a number of people, notably two men in sweatsuits sitting on a bench. It looks like they're inside the lobby of a hotel. Both men are sweating, or at least look to be sweating. There's a lot of camera equipment around them and people walking around, obviously making a movie. The caption reads, actors Mark Scarborough and Brett Gentile prepare to shoot a scene for A Box for Rob. And then under that's the headline in the article. The headline, Ready for Investors, Wake Forest Movie Company Wants to Try Public Market. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Wake Forest. With its first full-length film, a murder mystery set near Charlotte, nearly ready for release, independent film company Moving Box Entertainment is taking steps to file as a public company to raise money. Michael Davis, producer for Moving Box Entertainment, believes a stock listing would attract more investors by giving the young Wake Forest company a higher profile. It's hard to get people to put money in an individual, says Davis, but if you put together a more corporate side, it gives you extra credibility. Davis and his partners have filed a plan with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, in which the company would pick up the registration costs for 31 initial investors to sell 2 million shares of stock at 5 cents apiece. The company is negotiating with the registered market maker, Glendale Securities, to file an application to list Moving Box shares on the OTC Bulletin Board Exchange. The application would be filed with the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA, whose major responsibility is to make sure a company seeking a stock symbol is current with its financial reporting to the SEC, says FINRA's Nancy Condon. If all goes according to plan, Moving Box would become one of the Triangle's newest publicly traded firms. Although we anticipate that securing a qualification for quotation on the OTC bulletin board will increase liquidity for our stock, the Moving Box filing says, there is no assurance that our stock will ever trade on a market other than the OTC bulletin board. The registration costs associated with the shareholder sale are estimated at $25,000. None of the proceeds would go to the company, according to the SEC document. Formed in 2010, Moving Box raised $264,200, including $110,200 from company president Andreas Wilkin Jr. to make its first picture, A Box for Rob, a crime drama set in Concord near Charlotte. The cast includes a handful of experienced television and big screen actors, including Mark Scarborough of One Tree Hill and John Adams, the TV miniseries, Johanna Jouette of One Tree Hill and Life as We Know It, a full-length film, and Iron E. Singleton of The Walking Dead, a TV miniseries, and The Blind Side, a full-length film. Uptone Pictures Incorporated of Wake Forest was engaged to do the actual camera work on the 97-minute movie, which will begin making the film festival circuit in early 2011. It also will begin turning up in theaters. We are tied in with a number of distribution companies, says Davis, who adds that Movie Box's second film, which will be about wrestling, is already on the drawing boards. Moving Box is a newcomer in the state's video and film production industry, an industry that now encompasses 120 or so independent producers. Most make corporate, sports, and training videos and commercials. The number that make full-length feature films is small. I'd say a handful only, says Cary-based producer Christopher Smith-Nail, who adds that the industry's major problem remains the disconnect that exists between the creative people and the funding. In past projects, as well as his current one, a horror film to be shot in Wilmington, Smith-Nail says he turned to angel investors. The shooting of my new film would take 15 days, he says. Fundraising and other pre-production takes months. The notion of taking an independent film studio public is an intriguing one, he says, adding, however, seems to me, and this is just my opinion, that it's something that would work better for a company that has built up a larger library of films. And just to the right of that article, we have another article that runs vertically along the right side of the page. And first, at the top of the article above it, there's a picture of a man wearing a jacket, button-down shirt, open at the collar, sitting in a business setting. Caption reads, NCTA's Brooks Rayford points to growth in tech sector. And then under that, there's the headline, Teledyne's local ops expanding. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Durham. Thousand Oaks, California-based Teledyne Scientific and Imaging, which specializes in defense and aerospace industry work, is expanding its Durham research office with plans to begin adding jobs in 2011. Teledyne's Information Services Division is based in Durham and recently signed a deal to expand from about 5,000 square feet of space in the Park 40 building in Durham. It has had space in the building since the former Rockwell Scientific Unit was acquired by Teledyne Technologies Incorporated in 2006. The company's local operations, which has 25 employees, will more than double in space with the signing of a lease for 12,000 square feet in Durham's Central Park West Office Park on South Miami Boulevard, confirms Tucker Shade of the Tri-Properties real estate firm in Durham, who represented Teledyne in its lease negotiations. Lee Clyburn and David Mester of the Grubb & Ellis Thomas Linderman Graham real estate firm in Raleigh represented the landlord. Teledyne has several software developer, cyber research, and persistent surveillance research positions to fill in the triangle, and all candidates must be able to pass security clearance requirements. Mark Anderson, head of the company's Information Services Division in Durham, says the 7-year lease worth millions of dollars is a reflection of the company's commitment to the area. "We're excited about the growth strategy here," Anderson says. Job growth at Triangle Technology Companies has been picking up over the past few months after a dismal 2009, says Brooks Rayford, president and CEO of the North Carolina Technology Association. North Carolina as a state has seen year-over-year single-digit growth in technology jobs when overall the economy has seen job loss, he says. "We had 7 months in a row in 2010 with significant job opening increases, and it hasn't dipped much in the fourth quarter when companies traditionally slow hiring during the holidays." Rayford says he has been encouraged by news about companies such as smartphone developers, Research in Motion, Garmin, and HTC, that have opened research offices in the Triangle in recent months to attract workers from the area's technology talent pool. According to NCTA's December IT jobs trend report, IT job openings increased by 9.4% in November in North Carolina. More than 4,000 IT job postings were listed among companies across the state in November, which compared to only 1,770 postings the year prior. In the Triangle, about 47,500 people work in information technology fields. Teledyne Scientific's Durham office is the company's only location outside of California. It opened in 2000 and focuses its research on decision sciences for corporate and government client jobs. According to the company, the Durham operation has been involved in the development of ceramic composites for next-generation rocket nozzles, energy harvesting technologies, and imaging and sensor processing. The two scientific locations employ more than 250 people. Parent company, Teledyne Technologies Incorporated, has a market capitalization of $1.5 billion with 10,000-plus employees, according to Disclosure Insight, an investment research firm. The U.S. Department of Defense accounted for about 34% of Teledyne's total sales in 2009. The company employed about 8,100 people in 2009. State looking to find savings in agency buying habits. That's the headline of our next article. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. The North Carolina Department of Administration will take the lead in a 3-month search for cost savings in the state's massive procurement system. Reviewers will look at the buying patterns of state agencies, whether strategic sourcing, buying more from select vendors, should be adopted, and whether North Carolina's current online buying system needs a facelift or upgrade. They hope to have a set of recommendations in hand by March, ample lead time for possible legislative action in 2011. Reviewers have set a modest goal of achieving $30 million in saving over an unspecified period of time, but the system they will scrutinize involves thousands of vendors and transactions that go into the billions of dollars. Dubbing the effort Procurement Transformation, it promises to change the way the state does business in broad and substantial ways, says DOA Secretary Moses Carey. Over the past decade, the state has attempted to push more and more buying into its online platform, NCE Procurement. Through the life of that platform, as of December 19, it had chalked up nearly $3.3 million purchase orders valued at $15 billion and involving 71,911 vendors. North Carolina IT purchases for the fiscal year ending 2010 were $1.13 billion, according to State Controller David McCoy. As part of the review, DOA has emailed a survey to registered state vendors and has promised to keep them up to date on the study and its aftermath. The procurement review is being billed as part of the Purdue administration's bid to restructure state government in the face of a budget shortfall, now put at $3.7 billion. It also comes following a critical exam by State Auditor Beth Wood's office, saying that in some cases, departments have been approving contracts for the same goods or services with multiple vendors at different prices. To prove their point, auditors narrowed in on contracts for recycled printer toner cartridges, turning up 24 product purchases with multiple vendors in different prices, a series of transactions that cost the state $12,500 more than should have been paid. For toner cartridges, for example, agencies were buying new cartridges for $120.65 under one approved state contract, rather than buying cheaper, remanufactured ones for $28.37, wasting at least $41,211. When awards are not limited to the vendor offering the best value, potential savings from state term contracts will not be fully realized, Wood says. Contracts with different prices among vendors for the same product limits achievement of expected cost savings because agencies may not choose the vendor with the lowest price. The new DOA review is intended to rationalize the buying process. In addition to DOA, the state's IT office, the Office of Management and Budget, and the State Personnel Office will take part in the review. The study will include a large chunk of state government, but with a number of notable exceptions, including the legislature, the judiciary, the university system, and the K-12 school system. County and municipal governments also will be excluded. Road maintenance in North Carolina may suffer from $100 million cut. That's the headline on this article written by Chris Basden with a Dateline of Raleigh. Proposed cuts at the North Carolina Department of Transportation would slash more than $100 million from state-funded maintenance and resurfacing budgets over the next 2 years, according to a breakdown provided by the agency. The proposed cuts come at the behest of Governor Beverly Perdue, who is trying to fill a projected $3.7 billion gap in the state budget. Perdue asked all state agencies to make cuts, including requesting that North Carolina DOT prepare for a 5% reduction in revenue from the state's Highway Fund and Highway Trust Fund. NCDOT also receives a substantial portion of its funding from the federal government. Maintenance and resurfacing line items are among those that would be affected the most. NCDOT's proposal would make the following reductions in those areas. The $204.5 million authorized for primary road maintenance in the fiscal year 2012 budget would be reduced by $10.1 million in each of the next 2 years. The $297.4 million authorized for secondary road maintenance would be cut by $14.6 million in each of the next 2 years. The $274.5 million authorized for contract resurfacing would be slashed by $16.3 million in each of the next 2 years. The reserve fund for general maintenance, which sits at $37.8 million, would be cut by $4.3 million in each of the next 2 years. NCDOT spokeswoman Dara Demi says that line item is a discretionary fund used to provide repairs on both primary and secondary roads. It gives us some flexibility, she says. Another $5.4 million would be lopped off the $78.6 million currently budgeted for system preservation. Demi says that the line item covers small fixes such as ceiling cracks that are designed to extend the life of a road. Purdue is expected to use the recommendations from NCDOT in the budget proposal she will deliver to the legislature. Tom Crosby, a spokesman for Motorists Association AAA Carolinas, doesn't like to see reductions in maintenance programs. He says that deferring road maintenance results in a double whammy, more damage to cars in the short term and higher highway repair costs over the long haul. I think DOT does a good job with dwindling resources, but at some point, it's going to be a lost cause, Crosby says. Doing more with less has become a way of life at NCDOT, which has seen its revenue drop in recent years due to declines in the number of vehicles purchased and in the amount of gasoline bought by motorists. Taxes on both of those help fund the department's operations. At the same time, the department is trying to build the new roads required by the explosive growth the state has seen in the past decade. Mark Foster, NCDOT's chief financial officer, says the department won't sacrifice public safety due to the budget crunch. It certainly isn't being short-sheeted, he says, of maintenance. He's hopeful that all the cuts may not be necessary because NCDOT's revenue through the first 5 months of the fiscal year is 7% higher, or about $75 million, than it was a year ago. And now we have a moment to read from the opinion page. This opinion piece will read, is headlined, Time to End Free Ferry Rides in North Carolina. It's part of the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee. The North Carolina Department of Transportation operates the second-largest state-owned ferry system in the United States. It has 21 ferry vessels that serve 7 routes and transport more than 1.1 million vehicles and 2.5 million passengers annually. Generally speaking, it is a very pleasant ride for passengers and drivers alike. So why are we talking about a state-owned service that no one in the Triangle uses unless they are at the coast? Because at a time when the state is staring at a $3.7 billion budget shortfall, several agencies are being asked to do two things: cut costs and find new sources of revenue. We believe the ferry system offers an opportunity for the DOT to upgrade its fleet and improve its services. The system offers 7 different routes, and 4 of those routes, Hatteras, Ocracoke, Currituck, Knott's Island, Cherry Branch, Minnesot Beach, and Bayview Aurora, are free. All the rides but one are under an hour, and history has chronicled that North Carolina is proud to provide its residents and out-of-state tourists this service at no charge. The 3 other routes, Swan Quarter Ocracoke, Cedar Island Ocracoke, and Southport Fort Fisher, have a set fee for passengers and a variable fee schedule based on size of vehicles. We believe the state needs to start charging all passengers in vehicles using the ferry system. It is not fair for the state's 9.5 million residents to subsidize a service that is used only by 742,000 vehicles and 1.66 million passengers every year. That's the traffic from the 3 routes run by the ferry system, according to a 2009 report by North Carolina State University. As a chart accompanying this article shows, the entire North Carolina ferry system offers $26.3 million in travel time benefit for the riders. In return, the state spends about $18 million to run these services. But the bigger problem is when it is time to replace the ferries in the fleet. In 2008, the Washington State ferry system contracted for a construction of a 64-car ferry priced at $65 million, according to the NCSU report. In Virginia, the VDOT is replacing one of its smaller passenger ferries for $20 million. So where will all this money come from when the time comes to replace the fleet? For the system, the better option is to cut service with fewer ferries, and that may not work on certain routes such as the Cherry Branch Minnesot Beach route. According to the NCSU report, that route is the second most heavily used in the system, transporting nearly 280,000 vehicles and 490,000 passengers annually. There's only a small difference in ridership between July and February for this route, 13,000, indicating that a high proportion of travelers are local commuters. Already, during the summer of 2009, 32 sailings were eliminated in that route so the system could operate with one less vessel and one less vessel crew. Would it not make more sense to charge, say, $1 for passengers and $2 for vehicles and keep the service? Understanding that for locals who must get to jobs or shopping, that may be an expensive option, but state lawmakers can come up with a discounted system for these commuters. The days of free ferry service should be over. The NCSU report recommends a toll structure based on the length of a ride with a commuter pass that offers deep discounts. The report is right on in its recommendations given the fiscal condition of the state. Having heard some of the legislators in recent days talk about the deep government personnel and service cuts on the table, we believe we need to look at new ways of solving this massive deficit problem. Obviously, charging people to ride the state's ferry system is not the answer to all the problems, but it would be a start as agencies begin looking at ways to generate revenue without taxing its citizens. And for our remaining minutes, we'll look at the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Cipher Optics raises $21 million. Raleigh security and encryption company Cipher Optics says it has raised $21.09 million from 24 investors to complete its latest fundraiser. The company reported the results in a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Triangle Business Journal reported in November that Cipher Optics had raised $14.2 million in the round, which at that point had a target of $17.4 million. With the round reaching $21 million, the company has pushed its total venture haul to $48 million. Cipher Optics makes hardware and software that businesses use to secure their networks. Trial failure tortures Inspire investors. Shares of Inspire Pharmaceuticals nosedived after the Raleigh-based drug maker announced that its experimental cystic fibrosis treatment failed to reach the primary goal of its second Phase 3 clinical trial. The result was unexpected after the drug, dinifosal tetrasodium, fared well in the first Phase 3 study. Investors crushed Inspire stock, sending it down some 60% to a close of $3.47. The free fall took a heavy toll on major institutional investors, such as Warburg Pincus, which absorbed hundreds of millions of dollars in paper losses. North Carolina misses out on Mega Millions. You might say that North Carolina lost out on the $355 million Mega Millions jackpot. Two winning tickets were purchased, one in Washington State, the other in Idaho. The two states are neighbors and about as far away from the triangle as you can get in the contiguous 48 states. North Carolina didn't walk away without a trio of pretty good consolation prizes. Three players in the state won $250,000 each. Still, $250,000 ain't $355 million, which could have shared in if you had played the winning numbers 4, 8, 15, 25, 47, and 42. Those numbers are remarkably similar to the numbers played by the character Hurley in winning the lottery on the TV show Lost. Hurley's numbers were 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, and 42. And Hurley thought those numbers were unlucky. Morrisville Company sold. Alpheon Corporation, an IT services company based in Morrisville, has been sold to Waltham, Massachusetts-based Mindshift Technologies for an undisclosed sum, the companies announced. Alpheon, formed in 2002, specializes in providing managed IT services to small and mid-sized organizations with a focus on the healthcare market. In an interview with MSPMentor.com, Alpheon CEO Greg Donovan said that he had been in talks with Mindshift CEO Paul Chisholm for most of 2010. Donovan said that all 29 Alpheon employees have accepted employment agreements with Mindshift and that Alpheon is hiring aggressively. UNC again number one on Kiplinger's best value list. UNC Chapel Hill, for the 10th straight year, has claimed the title of the best value in public higher education by Kiplinger's Personal Finance. NC State took the number 15 spot in the rankings. And finally, Plastina steps down as Tekelec's CEO. Frank Plastina has stepped down as president and CEO of Tekelec, the Morrisville-based broadband data management company, announced. Plastina's resignation took effect January 4th. And we're going to stop there because we have run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.